Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Our sport is a risky sport.
We are at the mercy of the mountain itself.
Rock covered in snow and ice.
The risk of avalanches from bad weather.
Hypothermia.
Altitude sickness.
Exhaustion.
It's not a natural environment for survival.
Chasing mountains. Listen now by searching for amazing sports stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 4th of May, these are our main stories. Canadian police charged three Indian nationals over the killing of a Sikh activist last year. Egyptian mediators say Israel's given Hamas a week to accept its current ceasefire deal or face an Israeli offensive on Rafah. The Nigerian army says two officers are to face trial for last year's bombing of a village said to have killed over 100 people. And also in this podcast...
This is bad news, not just for the world of bullfighting, but also for the democracy and freedom of expression in this country.
Why Spain is abolishing a national bullfighting prize. Canadian police have arrested and charged three Indian nationals in connection with the killing of a prominent Sikh separatist leader in a suburb of Vancouver. Hardeep Singh Nijjar was shot dead by masked gunmen in a car park as he was leaving a Sikh temple last June. Superintendent Mandeep Mukha told journalists how they'd got to this point.
Through complex investigative techniques and tremendous support from the community, we were able to gather significant evidence that led us to the individuals that were responsible for this homicide. I'm here today to announce that we arrested and charged three individuals for first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder in relation to Hardeep Nijjar's homicide.
Let's get more on this from our correspondent, Will Vernon.
Police called this a significant development in this investigation that's been going on for many months now. There's been huge interest in this case. On Friday morning in Edmonton, police swooped and arrested these three men in three separate locations around the city, all of them Indian nationals in their 20s. And they are now in custody and they've all been charged with first-degree murder and conspiracy to murder in connection with the killing of Hardeep Singh Nijjar. Now, there was a lot the police couldn't tell us today in that news conference because they said the investigation is still ongoing. But they did say that they're investigating potential links that these men have with the Indian authorities. And that's the really, really interesting bit. He was a prominent Sikh leader, well known in the community. He was a Sikh separatist, a supporter of something that's known as Khalistan, which is an independent Sikh state within India. He moved to Canada in 1997. He married there, had two sons, worked as a plumber, and he was known locally as a vocal advocate for this Khalistan state. The Sikhs are a religious minority, 2% of India's population. He'd been branded a terrorist by the Indian authorities, and his friends said that before his killing, he'd received warnings that he was on a hit list. And he was murdered in the car park of a Sikh temple in June last year in the Canadian city of Surrey, near Vancouver. He was getting into his car when two men shot him, and he died at the scene. Last year, following that killing, Justin Trudeau said there were credible allegations that the Indian authorities were involved in the murder. That was denied by Delhi, who then accused Canada of giving shelter to extremists. And that resulted in a diplomatic rift between Ottawa and Delhi. There were expulsions of diplomats, lots of angry words. Of course, that was the main question that everyone wanted to know today in that news conference that the police held when they announced the arrest of these three men. What, if any, is the link with the Indian authorities? Now, they wouldn't say very much at all. They said that they're investigating the potential links. They're working with other agencies, including foreign intelligence, to try and get to the truth about whether India was involved.
That was Will Vernon reporting. For weeks, it was a question of when, not if, Israel would begin an offensive against Hamas in Rafah. Now, Egyptian mediators have told the Wall Street Journal that the government in Jerusalem has given Hamas 1 week to agree to a ceasefire and the release of the remaining hostages or face that onslaught. Hamas is apparently looking at the proposal. I've been talking to our Middle East analyst, Sebastian Usher.
This is a process that's been going on for months. Where we are at the moment, it seems more positive again in the signs that are coming out. A few days ago, there were meetings between the Israeli delegation and particularly Egyptian mediators. And from that, it seems that a modified proposal of some sort has been arrived at. That is a slight compromise from Israel from where it stood before. It had been saying that 40 prisoners, 40 women, the sick and the elderly of those still held in Gaza should be released in the first batch to go with a ceasefire. That didn't really get anywhere, I think mainly because Hamas doesn't actually believe that there's that number who fit that category still alive in Gaza. So now the number appears to have gone down to 33. The period for the ceasefire, 40 days. The issue is still over what Israel is saying, that it will continue, whether there's a ceasefire or not, whether there's a hostage deal or not, with its planned offensive in Rafah, the southernmost town in Gaza. That's on one side. On the other side, you have Hamas, which has publicly still been saying that one of its main conditions is that it needs to be a permanent ceasefire, not a temporary one. But we have been hearing some indications that there may be some move from the Hamas side as well. And we've heard now that the Hamas delegation will go to Cairo on Saturday and will, we believe, present its written response to this latest proposal. A Hamas official has been speaking, Hossam Badran, and he said that Hamas has been looking at this with a positive spirit. So there are some hopes that are rising here, but we have been here before and it hasn't led anywhere. So, you know, I think everyone is remaining very cautious.
The fact that hostages are being held for so long is clearly horrific for them and their families back home. But why would Hamas be tempted to release the hostages when by doing so they'd lose all their bargaining power?
The deal as it stands at the moment would not be for the full number of hostages to be released. Israel and parts of the Israeli government have been saying there's no point in doing a partial deal. There's no point in receiving 33 hostages because there may never be another deal, so they may not be able to get anyone else out. From a Hamas side, as you're saying, as the deal stands at the moment, they wouldn't be handing over all the hostages that they hold, so they would still have those cards to play, essentially, in negotiation. And in return, not just for ceasefire, but also a large number of Palestinian prisoners would be released. And I think for Hamas, that would be particularly important.
Our Middle East analyst, Sebastian Usher. In December last year, at least 120 people, many of them children, were killed when a drone hit a village in Kaduna State in northern Nigeria. At the time, the army said they'd mistaken them for terrorists. President Bola Tinubu described the tragedy as a bombing mishap. Well, now two army officers are to go on trial for their deaths. I've been talking to our correspondent in Nigeria, Chris Awoko.
Well, December last year, the Nigerian army carried out an airstrike in Kaduna State in northwest Nigeria. And basically, after the airstrike, over 100 people were left dead. And this was in a village. So there was an outcry from members of the community to say, hey, the Nigerian government and its agencies are targeting us and are killing our people. The military came out with a statement to say that they were targeting bandits and other members of jihadist group. But the cries from the community were persistent. And some investigations carried out also indicated that basically some civilian villagers were killed. And so when the information got out, the military went back in to investigate on their own and discovered that indeed they had made a blunder or a mistake.
So the people who were directing the drone, the army officers who were in charge, clearly made a terrible mistake and are now being put on trial.
Exactly. So before an airstrike is carried out, what we understand is that the military ought to do a kind of reconnaissance, do their investigation, recheck to confirm before they get the order to strike. And apparently, the information they got and passed to the higher command before they got the green light to strike was not correct. And so it seems that the officers who are responsible for those information are going to be put on trial.
So, Chris, this is like a military court-martial to determine whether or not the officers were negligent or not in what they did.
Yes, the officers will be subjected to a military trial, and if they're found culpable, they will be dismissed from the army and probably be now subjected to a kind of civil prosecution in a law court. But again, sometimes because they are military officers, there are also concerns about fairness for them. And then people are also asking if the military authorities are not just scapegoating these officers as a way of assuaging the anger of the people of the community and international partners.
Because it's obviously in the interests of the government and President Tinubu to calm things down and to bring some closure to the story, I suppose.
Clearly, yes. The government is keen to show to the international community, to the outside world, that Nigeria government and its agencies, especially the military, are law-abiding and they carry out the operations and engagements according to the law.
Chris Awoko in Nigeria. As heavy rainfall continues to pound East Africa, the president of Kenya, William Ruto, is warning his country could experience its first ever cyclone. He said more than 200 people have died so far in flooding and mudslides. Here's Richard Hamilton.
Cyclone Hidaya is gaining momentum as it travels along the coast of Tanzania. It's expected to make landfall this weekend and veer towards the biggest city of Dar es Salaam. In a televised address, President William Ruto said the cyclone could hit Kenya at any time. Already 200,000 people have been affected by the flooding, but President Ruto predicted that things will get even worse.
Meteorological reports paint a dire picture. The rains will persist, increasing both in duration and intensity for the rest of this month. Kenya may face its first ever cyclone. This cyclone, named Hidaya, could hit any time and is predicted to cause torrential rain, strong winds, and powerful and dangerous waves, which could potentially disrupt marine activities in the Indian Ocean and settlement along the Kenyan coast.
He's also ordered the evacuation of those in flood-prone areas. In the villages near the town of Mai Mahiu, southwest of Nairobi, more than 50 people were swept away by floodwaters as they slept. Among them were the two sons of 87-year-old Grishon Waiganjo.
I heard the sound of the water flowing down. I was in the house with my wife, my grandchild and great-grandchild. I told them to wake up and I said there was a flood coming. It came here. It didn't take 3 minutes. This whole compound was flooded and water started filling our home. This is our son's house. And the one who was swept away lived behind this house. We stayed in the house and prayed and said, God, you said you wouldn't destroy people with water, so flood again. Please help us.
President Ruto has also ordered schools to be closed indefinitely and urged the local authorities to reconstruct schools that have been damaged or destroyed. Nearly 180 dams and reservoirs have been identified as being at high risk of overflowing, with water levels of some of the dams at historic levels. The government says more than 100 refugee camps have now been set up to provide shelter for nearly 30,000 people.
Meanwhile, a heat wave in the Philippines has forced schools to close amid temperatures described by the government as dangerous. Antonio Yulo Loizaga is head of the government Department of the Environment and Natural Resources in the Philippines. She's been talking to my colleague Paul Henley about how people are coping.
In the heart of the city, it is scorching hot. We do have a lot of concrete, as you may imagine, in terms of these highly urbanized areas. But over in the rural areas as well, the heat index is hitting in the 40s. And we already have warnings, of course, in terms of the dangerous levels of heat.
and the heat index is higher than the actual temperature. It takes into account the humidity and how the body feels the heat. Is that right?
That's right. And so we have a heat index ranging from over 38 to 40
degrees Celsius.
Some areas, Celsius, yes, and 48. Our highest, in fact, in terms of the heat index, happened in April 28, where we had one area, which is the Zambales area, hitting 53.
In terms of how you feel the heat as an individual, what is the sensation? I know the demand for those who are lucky enough to have air conditioning systems is huge, putting a strain on the system. How badly do you need aircon in these temperatures?
Well, absolutely necessary in terms of the need for air conditioning, but we all know that affordability is a challenge, and therefore out on the street, especially for those that do service deliveries, for example, it is punishing. And the sensation on your skin feels almost like, you know, you're pretty close to burning up.
To an extent, you'll have anticipated this heat. What sort of adaptations, mitigations have been made by the government?
Well, in terms of adaptation, certainly in the sectors, agriculture is among the first sectors that needed to adapt. And we're now exploring different ways of planting our staple, which is rice, and of course, exploring very climate resilient crops. In the water sector, we have been working for some time on planning our integrated water resources management systems and anticipating how there can be, for example, the possibility of small desalination facilities for isolated islands, which hardly have any water anyway.
And that was Antonia Yulo-Loizaga, head of the Government Department of the Environment and Natural Resources in the Philippines. It's only lasted for a decade. Now the national prize for bullfighting in Spain is being abolished. It's a decision made by the culture minister, Ernest Urtasun, of the left-wing Catalonia in Common Party, which forms part of Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez's governing coalition. Aficionados of bullfighting have criticised it. The president of the biggest bullfighting organisation, Victoriano Martín, said the reasons were political.
This is bad news, not just for the world of bullfighting, but also for the democracy and freedom of expression in this country. It's cultural censorship for ideological reasons.
I found out more from our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt.
Well, Ernest Urtasun there said public money shouldn't be used as a reward for what is animal abuse. The prize was $32,000. He said the majority of Spanish people don't agree with the mistreatment of animals. He himself is a long-term opponent of bullfighting, and he set this in the context of a wider background of animal welfare legislation passed in 2023.
We know that bullfighting is part of Spanish culture. How popular is it now, though?
Minister Urtasun quoted statistics from 2021 to 22 that said 1.9% only of the Spanish population actually attended a bullfight. The picture is obviously more complex than that. It's a very, very polarising issue. So the people that do support it very, very passionately. And they talk about it as being an art, and they dismiss animal welfare, saying that the bulls that ultimately meet a very gory end have a good life up to that point. Whereas other people, of course, say it's a cruel, barbaric sport that turns, it makes a spectator sport of torture. And broadly across the nation, opinion polls suggest that about 45% of Spanish people want to ban it. About 30% oppose a ban, but they also don't want to subsidise it. And about 24% of people want it subsidised.
Many countries have culture wars in their politics at the moment. Is that what this is in Spain?
This very much plays into that sort of thing, Andrew. So broadly, it's not absolutely monolithic, but there's a broad left-right divide on this. So right-wing parties, particularly the far-right party Vox, but also the Partido Popular, the centre-right party, want to either subsidise or not ban it. And the parties on the left want to ban it. So that's the broad thing. It is more complicated, and there's also regional differences as well. So, for example, the Canary Islands banned bullfighting a long time ago, and Catalonia banned it more than a decade ago. So these things are regional as well as party political.
Our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt. Still to come in this podcast.
What we really want to show is how he actually lives with that reputation while also facing the growing challenges of ageing, because he dies at the age of 88, but quite remarkably, he is working several days before he died.
A new exhibition looking back at the final years of the life of the artist Michelangelo. South Korea's foreign ministry has raised the alert level for its diplomatic missions in several countries. It says it's received intelligence that North Korea may attempt to harm its officials. More from our correspondent in Seoul, Jean McKenzie.
South Korea has raised the terror threat alert at three of its embassies abroad, so in Laos, Cambodia and Vietnam, and also at two of its consulates, so in Russia and China. And what they are saying is that they have intelligence that North Korea has sent operatives to these five countries, and that those operatives are now planning attacks either on its embassies or on its diplomatic staff. But we don't know any more about what these planned attacks were, what form that they would take. What we do know, though, is that these five countries all have very good relations with North Korea. And so it means that their operatives in these countries would have more freedom to operate. And what's particularly interesting is what the intelligence services have told us this morning. Now, they have said that over the past year, a significant number of North Korean diplomats and high-level officials who are posted overseas have defected. Now, when North Koreans are posted overseas, they are monitored quite closely by security agents. And so when they escape, it is these security agents that can get the blame. And so what the intelligence services have told us is that these security agents have fed back to Pyongyang that the people who've escaped were actually tricked by South Korean officials. They have fed this back, presumably, to stop themselves from being punished for these defections. But what it means is that North Korea is now seeking to retaliate. And as part of this retaliation, it is planning these attacks on these South Korean officials overseas.
The judge overseeing Donald Trump's hush money trial has corrected the former president's false assertion that a gag order prevented him from testifying on his own behalf. At the beginning of the session, Justice Juan Marchan told Mr. Trump he had an absolute right to testify. Mr. Trump has pleaded not guilty to criminal charges of falsifying business records to cover up payments to the porn actress Stormy Daniels. Yesterday, the court heard from Donald Trump's longtime aide, Hope Hicks. Our correspondent Neda Tarfik was there.
She is the first person who worked directly with Donald Trump to testify. And, you know, we didn't really have to guess how she felt about taking the stand. She said once she got on that she was really nervous and even broke down in tears at one point, at which the court took a short break. But look, Hope Hicks has depicted Donald Trump as somebody who was, across all of the media statements that she worked on, was very much a part of his press strategy and all of the statements that went out. So somebody that was very in tune with how the press coverage would be affecting him and his campaign. She discussed how the campaign was in crisis after the Access Hollywood tape, how it was wall-to-wall media coverage for 36 hours until the presidential debate, even knocking a real Category 4 hurricane off of the news, she said. And then she got to the actual article that went out exposing the Stormy Daniels payment. And she said that Donald Trump had told her that that the affair never happened, to deny the affair in press statements. And that when Michael Cohen told the New York Times that he had made the payment, that Donald Trump told her that he was very loyal and he had paid off this woman as a favor to him. And when prosecutors asked her if that sounded like something Michael Cohen would do, she said it did seem out of character for him, that he was someone who liked to take credit and wasn't exactly a charitable person. So overall, some pretty devastating testimony for the defense that they now have to contend with on cross-examination.
Neda Tarfik in New York. Top Indian wrestlers have criticised Prime Minister Narendra Modi's party for fielding the son of their former federation chief in national elections, despite his father being charged with sexually harassing female wrestlers. This from our South Asia regional editor, Ambarasan Ethirajan.
A celebrated Olympic medal-winning female wrestler, Sakshi Malik, said by giving an election ticket to Brijbhushan Singh's son, the BJP had shattered the aspirations of India's millions of daughters. Karan, the son of Mr. Singh, is standing as the BJP candidate in Kaisarganj constituency in Uttar Pradesh, a seat his father has won 6 times. In January, police filed charges against Mr. Singh after several women wrestlers accused him of sexual harassment when he headed India's top wrestling body. He denies wrongdoing and is currently on bail.
Bee populations have been in decline since the 1950s around the world. Now a new study from Canada thinks it might have found the reason why. The team from the University of Guelph point to rising temperatures boiling bees in their own nests. Here's Stephanie Prentice.
Bumblebees spend a substantial part of their life pollinating plants and flowers, returning to underground nests they burrow into the ground. But a new study says those nests are under threat, with rising global temperatures making bumblebee nests too hot for them to survive in. The researchers reviewed studies dating back to the 1800s and found that regardless of species or region, bumblebees prefer a nest temperature around 28 and 32 degrees Celsius. When nest temperatures surpassed 36 degrees, the bees couldn't reproduce. It also found that one heat wave could wipe out a generation of young bees. Study lead author Dr. Peter Kevin looked at bees in many different environments and concluded heat could be the top threat to the species.
On a scale of 1 to 10, I think global climate change is in the top. It's probably, my concern would be about 7.5, 8. But then, of course, there's all the issues of pesticide, land use, a lot of serious things going on.
Bumblebee populations also have habitat loss to contend with, particularly as floods become more frequent. And as their numbers dwindle, the implications for humans intensify. Professor Nigel Rain is an environmental expert specialising in pollination.
Bees are incredibly important for the pollination of many fruits, vegetable and nut crops. So they're really important in managing the breadth of our diet. And many of the micronutrients we rely on are produced by those crops. So we could survive without bees, but our diet would be very depauperate. So it would be a very different dietary landscape.
The scientists are now calling for more research into how bumblebees can survive rising temperatures around the world.
Michelangelo was born in 1475 and grew up in Florence. 5.5 centuries on, he remains one of the world's most influential artists of all time. A new show at the British Museum in London looks at part of his life which is sometimes neglected, the years Michelangelo spent in Rome before he died at the age of 88. Vincent Dowd went to see the exhibition.
Grant Lewis has curated a show about the late life of someone art lovers adore, but is there anything new to say about Michelangelo as he was in a new home and reaching 60?
It's one of the really most fascinating parts of his life. The most famous works, the Sistine Chapel, the David. This is how he gets the reputation as Europe's most famous artist. But what we really want to show is how he actually lives with that reputation while also facing the growing challenges of ageing, because he dies at the age of 88, but quite remarkably, he is working several days before he died.
The artist fell out of favour in the Florentine state, and in 1534 he moved to Rome. There, Michelangelo, even in periods of ill health, was incapable of limiting himself to any single medium.
Most of the period we're looking at, he is spending most of his time as an architect. And we also have Michelangelo's sonnets, incredibly powerful, raw, emotive works, which I think add a whole new facet to Michelangelo's creativity that we're not so familiar with. And we also have Michelangelo's letters, which show deliveries of cheeses, deliveries of wines, and he does attribute part of his recovery to Trebbiano wines, which I can totally get on board with.
Into his 80s, he worked on countless projects, which the exhibition illustrates, including designs for rebuilding St. Peter's Basilica.
So this is a black chalk sketch, about 25 centimetres by 40 centimetres, of the dome.
No one had attempted a dome anything like this since Filippo Brunelleschi had made the dome for Florence Cathedral well over 100 years earlier. And of course he knew this was going to be the thing that would dominate Rome, the dome you'd see far into the Roman countryside. So it is a major preoccupation for him.
But it was finished after his death.
Long after his death, yes. And he knew this, and I think it's quite a remarkable thing to think that here's Michelangelo working on something that he knew he would never see.
Grant Lewis says there was an emotional life, though the detail is now lost to us.
You see it very strongly in some of the sonnets, where he really does pour his heart out with incredible candour. Michelangelo is obsessed with dynasty, and if you look at some of the letters we have in the show, one of his main preoccupations at this time is making sure that his family line continues. He knew he was not going to have any children, so he really does pester his poor, long-suffering nephew to get married, to make sure that the family line continues.
Do you think he ever thought, I'm right at the end of my life? Did he ever even think in those terms?
If I'm honest, I think he thought that for the entire 30 years covered by this show. I think every project he probably approached thinking this might well be his last. He would have had absolutely no idea in 1534 when we start this show that he would have been working for another 30 years.
And that centuries later, we still love his work.
I hope he'd be thinking we'd be celebrating at least some of his works. He certainly made St. Peter's Basilica with a view to permanence, and I think he'd be rather pleased to see that much of his design was eventually carried out. As for some of these drawings, I think he'd be slightly less pleased that we were seeing the inner workings of his mind.
The new show at the British Museum reminds us that long after he worked on the Sistine Chapel or created the world-famous sculpture of David, Michelangelo's extraordinary energies were as strong and as diverse as ever.
Vincent Dowd reporting. And that's all from us for now. Later we'll have this week's Happy Pod to download. If you'd like to comment on this edition of the Global News Podcast and the stories we included, drop us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. On X, we are at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chesney Fawkes Porter. The producer was Stephanie Tillotson. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.